So this is not really a lecture. Basically, you can ask me questions and I can say whatever I want, and you can argue and we can disagree. But Olivier originally wanted to see these slides that I have on my webpage, which I told him that's a presentation that I've given to incoming PhD students many times. So those will certainly serve as a starting point. They don't have that deep wisdom, but they are one of the most popular items on my webpage. So I'll start talking based on these slides, random thoughts on the PhD program. I've been told that they're much more useful for more senior PhD students, but we have a pretty good mixture here. So maybe you'll find them useful, maybe not. But I think you can tell that the tone of the entire thing will be afraid, be very afraid. So I'm a fairly cynical person when it comes to some things. So I'll try to tell you what I view cynically and maybe how you should view things, or maybe how you should not view things. So, yeah. What do you mean?
Olivier
is longer. This one should be over in 35 minutes. But other than that, yeah, it's going to be at the same level, hopefully. So it's a meta presentation.
The same words? Just faster, I guess.
Well, I'm not going to tell you how to write a paper. I'm not going to tell you how to give a talk. I'm not going to tell you how to find a committee. And certainly, I disagreed with many of Olivier's points, as I mentioned yesterday. Mostly the very minor ones, like, for instance, that you should always thank the anonymous reviewers. I think that makes it an empty gesture. I never thank the anonymous reviewers unless they actually said something that was useful. Only then I thank them, and then it's a nice acknowledgement because it's meaningful, and I'm happy to see that myself. Because otherwise, if I always were to thank the anonymous reviewers, they wouldn't be happy to see that. It's just a formality. So small points I may disagree with Olivier about. And then there are the philosophical points, and those are big. And we primarily agree. So you all know what a PhD is. Most of you, 90% of you are PhD students. And many of the rest of you have a PhD. So a PhD is an advanced graduate degree for the ability to do research. And research is the production of new knowledge. I don't think there's much question about those things, although some people may question them. Oh, what is research? I think that's actually fairly well defined. But I think a more interesting question is, why does one want to do a PhD? And why do you want to do a PhD? And frankly, in most settings, it may not make financial sense. I mean, in the US, it's marginal whether it makes any sense. In many other countries, there's no way that it makes financial sense. So basically, you don't make more money if you get a PhD than you would if you were to work as many years out in the industry. So probably that's not the reason why you should do it. So, and some people do it for the completely wrong reason, which is because being a student is fun and I don't know how to do anything else. So I might as well stay a student for a few more years. And look, I even get a small salary or something like that. So why not? It's good, it's fun. Well, so definitely I would say don't do it for that. There's only one good reason to do a PhD. Can you hear that?
The reason is to be a dead end.
I thought it was somebody's cell phone ringing.
Well, there are quotes from Star Wars everywhere. I know, but that's a completely different kind of sound. And the speakers are just under the keyboard here, so it's not like I can easily.
Well,
I'm sorry?
Aren't they right here on the front? Yeah. At the bottom? Yeah, exactly.
Right here? Let's try.
So you got the theme. So
my point is that if you're fascinated by computer science and you want to go deep, then do a PhD. That's the right reason to do it. So if you're here to be a Jedi Knight, that's the right reason. If you just want to continue being a student, that's the wrong reason. If you think it makes financial sense, or you're doing it because your dad has a PhD, or you're doing it because your family will think, oh, this is so great, no good reason. No good reason to do it.
Because it
requires a lot of commitment. And you only have that if you really love what you do and you really want to go deep. So I think the PhD years are very tough years, or at least that was my experience. So I call them the years of disillusionment. Because at first, you go in and you think, oh, I can do everything. And you get disappointed.
I am ready. I can be a Jedi. Ben, tell him I'm ready.
So
there's not going to be that much more in terms of Star Wars. There are a few sound bites here and there. So new students typically think they know everything, and you see the gap, there's one more sound bite.
So much.
So this is actually the number one thing that advisors ask. Will he finish what he begins? It's considered the number one predictor of success in grad school. I have a very good friend. I had a good friend when I was a grad student, John Gunnels, who's now at IBM. He's had a great career. He was saying, there should be only one test to enter the PhD program. You know, nothing to do with GREs or anything else. It should be just go to an open fire and grab a log, and if you can hold it for 5 seconds while your hand is burning, that's the only test. Then you're in. Otherwise, you're not in. That should be the only test. It's all about perseverance and persistence. Nothing else. Nothing to do with talent or any knowledge that you have when you come in. So there's a lot that's required to go through the whole thing. And you're not going to be able, most likely, to make contributions right away. It doesn't matter if you're good programmers. It doesn't matter if you're great in math, you will not be able to make a contribution right away because whatever area you choose will always have been well explored. The shallow results have already been picked up. And you'll need to learn a lot to continue from there. At the same time, you can learn that. And once you are at the top, every direction you go is up. When you are above everyone else, every direction, anything you do, anything you think of is new. So there's lots of bad news that you will find out during your PhD. And that's page 1 of 56, according to me. So there are people who are better than you. Most of you probably knew that already from your undergrad, but many of you did not, because you were the cream of the crop as undergrads or as master's students. That's why you entered the PhD program. Well, now it's time to figure out that there are people who are better than you. And you're not good at everything. You may be good at some things, but many people come into grad school and they are the best person in their class in math and in programming and in some other kind of thinking. Now, well, there's no way that's going to continue. You will have some strengths. Play to your strengths because you're not going to be the top person at everything. There will be someone who's better than you, multiple people probably, at one of those things. So try to find your strengths and play to those. And of course, there are all the ugly lessons, because life is very unfair. So there will be people who are not as good as you in every possible way. They're not as smart. They don't work hard. But they will do better work. They will get better results. And to make matters worse, There are people who will get worse results, but who will have much better careers than you. And that's a fact of life, and you should learn to accept it. There will be people who will get nothing. They'll have amazing jobs because they went to a better school, better known school, or they are in a sexier field, or their advisor is better known. Or because their advisor had a better chemistry with them and wrote them a better recommendation letter. Life is unfair, and you'll find out. That's the biggest thing that you will find there. So don't do it because you expect the rewards. Do it because you like it. So that's bad news. Well, there's more bad news. And of course, that's just a sampling, since we said page 1 of 56. It's not enough to be good at courses. Yes?
On the last slide, should we assume that the reviewer is smarter than us?
I do not know. This is a very interesting question. What's better, to assume that the reviewer is smarter than us or not? Well, it depends on one's point in their career. If they think that they have room for improvement and they can take something from a reviewer's lack of understanding of the paper, sure, that's a positive impact. But there are idiot reviewers, and I think that's the problem with that's a point where I disagreed with Olivia yesterday. There are idiot reviewers. It's all a human process. Humans are fallible. It doesn't mean that all reviews we get are right. It doesn't mean that all reviews we get are reasonable. It doesn't mean the process for making decisions is reasonable. Sometimes it can be very unfair, and some people may not have thought about some things very carefully. Now, if a reviewer has not understood the paper at all, then probably there's something to be gained from that, because probably there is some major presentational error. But are there errors in judgment? Absolutely. So I was saying that being good at courses is not enough during the PhD. I mean, the standard maxim goes, so I heard that once from an engineering professor, so that may be a bit influenced by the area. But the guy was saying, for an undergrad, I give them questions, I expect the answers. For a master's student, for undergrads, I expect them to give me questions and I give them the answers. For a master's student, I give them questions, they give me the answers. For a PhD student, I expect them to give me both the question and the answer. So certainly you are expected to do some things on your own. And doing courses is not enough. Also, doing what you're told may not be enough. So very often, in order to be successful, you have to do things outside what you're told. You have to formulate questions yourselves. You have to decide for yourselves what's interesting and follow it independently of an advisor. And of course, the obvious question becomes, well, then what does that loser advisor do for me? I just get their name on the paper? And well, it depends. There are advisors who just get their names on papers. I'm not going to deify advisors and say, they're the wise sages and they will always guide you well. Some people will not guide you well. But as a principle, most advisors have been around for a while. If you chose them, and assuming you chose wisely, you had some reason to choose them. Probably they have some things to teach. And probably they are smart, they know the area, they can tell you some very, very useful things. But still, you'll need to formulate questions. You'll need to be able to prove that you are an independent researcher. That's what doing a PhD is all about. Now, that sounds kind of boring, and to some extent you've already heard that. The other bad news is that the PhD years are the time of insecurity. If you don't know what I mean, it means you are in your first or second or maybe third year. If you are more advanced, you probably know what I mean. So you will often wonder, can I do this? Am I good enough to do this? And if you're here for the right reason, then you are good enough to do this. So if you're here to be a Jedi Knight, you can do research, and you can definitely do this. You can definitely finish a PhD and do good research. If you're in your first years, you may wonder, can I do research? Oh, all I've done in my past is courses, but research is this new thing. Can I really do it? Can I really produce new ideas? It's exactly what I said before. You're going on a trip, and you're following the paths that others have taken. At a certain point, if you've walked far enough, anything from that point on is new. So it's just a matter of exploring enough the paths that others have taken and getting to the very edge. And after that, it's no different. You're still just walking. And you're exploring new territory. And some of this new territory is, frankly, pretty boring. 90% of the research out there is nothing to write home about, at least for me. So, you know, you have to decide what's exciting new territory to explore. Also, you may wonder why all the people around me publish and I don't. Depends. Maybe, maybe not. You know, maybe some of you have already published or already published regularly. But certainly, there's a lot of insecurity with respect to that. And really, don't worry about that at all. I mean, concentrate on what you do and don't try to evaluate yourself based on post-PhD criteria. Don't try to say, oh, this person has 3 papers and I don't have any. Yeah, like for anyone who's gonna observe things, they're gonna care that they have 3 papers and you have 0. Like the number is gonna shock them. 3, wow, so overwhelming. It's not gonna matter. It doesn't matter until you're much more senior. And you shouldn't really concentrate on that at all. You should concentrate on doing something really, really good. Because when you're done with a PhD, the people who are going to hire you for your first job, either as a postdoc or as an assistant professor or as anything, depending on what system you are going to look for a job in, it's going to be based on promise, not based on accomplishment. And I'll say that again. If you've done one thing and it's a great thing, you have much better prospects than having done 5 little silly things. Of course, that's me now being idealistic, being Olivier. So take that with a grain of salt. There's noise there, life is unfair, all those things. So here are some good news for a change. The good news is you can stay there forever. So that's the best thing one can say. At least in the US, you can stay a PhD student for a long time. And time stops. So no one will really ask you, oh, you took 8 years to get a PhD? Oh, my cousin did it in 4. Like, you don't care about these people anyway. I mean, they're not going to affect your future career. People know that if you're dealing with a topic seriously, it may take some time, and it's completely unpredictable how long it will take. There are many people who did remarkable PhDs and took a very long time. Of course, there are many people who did very lousy PhDs who took a very long time. But that doesn't mean anything. Stay with the first one. There are many people who took a very long time and did remarkable PhDs, which is great. Time is on your side. Have a good excuse to hide from society, do your thing, go deep, and no one will matter. No one will mind. And the timeline is very uncertain. I'll say that again. You really never, never know when you've seen enough and you can produce interesting things. You may work on a very hard problem and not get anything for 3 years. But if you make progress after 3 years, probably you're the only person in the world who managed to make progress on such a hard problem, which is remarkable. And of course, well, you have a life, so it's not so easy to do that forever. Because to do this, to stay a PhD student, you have to ignore many real-life concerns. I don't know what situation most of you are in. How old are you? How much you're getting? But probably you're not getting anything that compares to a salary. It's probably much lower. And you have a stipend, which may be okay when you're 20, 22, 23, but will it be okay when you're 30? Well, around the time I was graduating, I didn't have time to buy Christmas presents. I was thinking, I better graduate sometime soon and start getting a real salary. So you'll see your friends, and they will start careers, and they will have decent salaries, and they will buy cars, and they will buy houses, and maybe they'll start families much more comfortably financially than you will, and you won't be able to do these things. So you will be spending the best part of a decade in a time warp. I'm thinking of where my 20s went. They went to a PhD. I don't even remember that much outside anything that had to do with a PhD during my 20s. Not that I worked that hard, but certainly I changed countries to come do my PhD in the US. And then I worked on a topic fairly intensely, and everything in my life had to do with this. So certainly that's a warped decade for me. So the next thing about a PhD is that you control your fate. Probably part of good news rather than bad news. But it does put a lot of responsibility on your shoulders. So you have some control of your destiny. And I like to say you have control of your destiny. Realistically, you don't have full control of your destiny. I mean, that's, again, life is unfair. There are biases that will prejudice things no matter what you do. But generally, if you do great work, you have a very high likelihood of getting noticed in most communities. Well, there are communities that cannot tell quality work. But if you are in a community that does, that can tell quality work, then you will be noticed if you do great work. And there are no preset boundaries. Your peer group is everyone out there. Your peer group is everyone in this room, and more importantly, 20 times more people who are not in this room. So you don't have any boundaries. You're competing with the entire community. And that's a good thing, because if you're an undergrad and you come from a school that nobody knows, I came from school XYZ, someone comes from school XYZ in country W, that predetermines what grad school you can go in, no matter how good you are. During PhD time, there are no preset boundaries. You're not just competing with the local people. You're competing with everyone in the community. So good and bad. So certainly my idealistic advice is to strive to improve yourself. Definitely try to acquire as much background as you can and go for something really, really interesting. It should definitely inspire you. And you are in the ideal position to make significant contributions. Professors are not. Professors have very, very fragmented time, no way to delve into something really deeply, no way to make fundamental contributions, or very little way. Maybe in theory, professors can make some fundamental contributions because experience matters tremendously. But in anything a little more applied, they don't even have the time to go and study something in depth and try to see it from a completely different angle. But you do. So, of course, this is idealistic advice, and Olivier gave a lot of idealistic advice yesterday, like the excellent, amazing advice, which I strongly subscribe to, but it may not be good for your career to always reveal in your paper both the strengths and the weaknesses, and then let the reviewers judge. It may not be good career advice, but I recommend that you do it, and I recommend that you do it for the good of your soul, not because it's good career advice. So anyway, anything idealistic, keep in mind that it may be survivor advice. And what I mean by that? Well, if other people have followed my advice and they have died in the way, they're not here to tell you otherwise. It's like someone who plays Russian roulette and tells you, it's a great way to make money. Look at me, I'm a millionaire. Of course, but, you know, there are many more people who played 6 rounds of Russian roulette and now are in the graveyard. So, but of course, the one person who's there has won a lot of bets. So the survivor will tell you always, oh, go for it, even if it's very risky. So generally, take what I say with a grain of salt, but, you know, doubt everyone else as well. So there are more good news. PhD life can be great fun. If you're here to be a Jedi Knight, it can be great fun because you are a student, but you have some funds to support yourself. And you will work on the most interesting things in the world because you pick them. They should be interesting to you. There's a lot of freedom, very few obligations. Think of yourself as a freelance photographer. I just go around. I can be anywhere I want, any time of the day. I just have to finish these tasks because I have a contract to do these. You're free. And this freedom is very, very valuable. So when I was a PhD student, the department chair at Texas was Jay Misra, and he said, "This is the only time in your life that someone will pay you to learn. And I challenge you to tell me otherwise." And people were saying, "Oh, no, come on, my company sends me to learn." No, your company just gives you training for company purposes. This is the only time in your life you will be paid, and the only expectation is that you learn. Not because you're going to benefit anyone, but because you're going to benefit yourself, and through your benefit, the university will benefit. So, final pieces of advice. First of all, are there any questions or objections or anything else? Am I preaching too much? Okay. How to pick an area?
I'm not going to call anything
here, so it's just a random Star Wars reference. There are many different kinds of research in computer science. There's scientific research, and my definitions are what's on the slide. I call scientific research anything that's based on analysis. Anything that takes an area and it breaks it down to little components and it works on the little components as rigorously as possible, even when it's not clear immediately how working on the little components resembles working on the big problem. So if you're doing scientific research, if you're doing research based on analysis, the standard objection is, oh, but does this apply to the real world? Because when you add this extra complication that in real world you also have five orders of magnitude change in latency, all this breaks down. Yeah, sure, it breaks down. It's an abstraction. We work with the abstraction. That's what's called scientific research. The complement of that is engineering research. It's research based on synthesis, which tries to take the little results that are known and tries to build larger solutions that hopefully do apply to the real world from all the small ones that are abstract enough and maybe don't apply to the real world. So those are the two big sides of the coin. Now, yeah.
So when someone raises that objection, how do you respond?
An objection to this, to scientific research? I have to make simplifying assumptions because otherwise we cannot reason about this. So that's exactly what all science does. We simplify, we abstract away, we figure out the problem after we have abstracted away, and only after that we find some way to map this back to the original problem. If you think about it, that's exactly what all of science is doing. Like, macroscopically, not microscopically, not the way that physicists and chemists do research every day, but if you look at the development of physics and chemistry, all the sciences, or biology, for instance, this has been the traditional pattern. You know, physics started with, or chemistry started with, how do we turn lead into gold? And someone says, well, we'll analyze the elements. And people would always say, yeah, but how does this apply to our real problem? How do you turn lead into gold? All you told me is about those gases. I don't care about gases. I care about how to turn lead into gold. Don't you remember that's the problem you set out to solve? Yeah, but, you know, we're trying to understand something much more fundamental. We're trying to break into pieces that we can work with. And hopefully, many centuries later, someone will know, hey, if you want to turn lead into gold, well, it turns out you have to spend a lot more energy than the value of the gold you're going to get back, but at least we know now how to do it after all these centuries. Yeah.
I was wondering, what's the difference between engineering research and working at a company?
Well, the company's goal is not to do research. Company's goal is not to produce new knowledge. The company is perfectly fine with old knowledge as long as it makes them money, right? So it depends on what the company does. So think of a company. Think of, say, software companies. Do they necessarily produce something that is interesting from a knowledge standpoint, that is novel and interesting from a knowledge standpoint?
Engineering, we're just reusing or applying.
Just because it has
applicability to the real world, it doesn't mean that it's research. Of course, engineering research, the way I described it, has applicability to the real world. You're trying to compose an actual solution. Of course, in research, we don't really compose engineering products typically. We compose prototypes or something that would have applicability to the real world, but would require a lot more labor and effort to be a real product typically. But most companies are not cutting edge. They're not trying to produce new knowledge. Is there engineering research that's being done at companies? Absolutely. The same way as there's science, scientific research, that's being done completely outside scientific fields. Someone may be doing music. They may be a professor of music and they may be doing scientific research there. It's all about the methods. Very similarly, companies can be doing engineering research. Few companies, the ones that most people are happy to get a good job at, to be doing research of this kind, and they may not call it research. So I agree, it's not the clearest boundary, because obviously when I say research is a new contribution to knowledge, that's kind of subjective. Someone may say, well, for me, this is research. This is interestingly novel for me. But generally, it's fairly well accepted inside the knowledge community, what is research and what's not. Okay, so should you try to predict the future? So we're asking again, how do you pick an area? Now, my thesis here is that you should not think of what will be employable in the future, or at least you shouldn't think about this too much. You think about it a little as general directions. You know, if you suddenly think, oh, yeah, I think that complexity theory will be so employable in the future, yeah, you know, you're on shaky ground there. You're probably going to be wrong. But if you pick an area because it has lots of jobs today, it doesn't mean that it's going to have lots of jobs 5 years from now. So in the 80s, AI was hot. Everything was going to be AI. I mean, Olivia was talking about the fifth generation, the Japanese project. In the early 90s, when I was in grad school, everything was multimedia. Oh, multimedia is so hot. No one was saying I do systems. I do operating systems or file systems. No, everyone was doing multimedia. Do you know of anyone nowadays who says my research area is multimedia? Are there any major conferences on multimedia? I mean, it doesn't even exist as a concept. All these people have had maybe successful careers, but in slightly different areas. So this has disappeared. It was a buzzword, it disappeared. Now we have security, now we have biocomputing, biofoo, as people say. Anything you compose with bio is a gold mine these days. In 5 years, maybe not so much, because there will be enough people. So don't take that as your primary criterion for how to pick an area, because by the time you graduate, you may find that the area is saturated. The other thing that people often do is they pick an area based on the importance in the real world. Hey, this is so important. What's most important is to design computers that help real people. Absolutely, that's really important. But it's a real world problem. So it has a lot of noise and a lot of complications that have to do with the setting. And there's a reason these problems have not been solved. They're very complex. They may not be amenable to any systematic solution. They may not be research problems at all. So if you're thinking you're going to solve world hunger, you know, go be a politician and in 4 years you won't have done anything, and in 40 years you won't have done anything, but fine, do that. If you want to work on something that you have a chance at solving, because it's a research problem, it can be well formed, then you should not concern yourself with, oh, but this is so hot in the real world. The real world has its own problems. And the term problem in the real world means something entirely different. For the scientific world, for the research world, problem is a good thing. It's something that we attack and we try to solve. For the real world, problem is something that you cannot solve. So don't be tempted by that confusion. Concentrate on mode of research is my advice. So you can't even really pick an area. I mean, most people here, all the people here are in programming languages, so the advice has to apply for sub-areas of programming languages. And programming languages is not such a heterogeneous area, although it has enough heterogeneity. But let's look at other areas. Take networking or software engineering. In networking, there are people who are pure theoreticians. All they're doing is theory. There are people who are mathematicians. All they're doing is statistics and Markov modeling. There are people who don't know anything about any of those, and all they're doing is hacking every day and writing code. There are people who don't know anything about hacking, but they know to talk about protocols. You can be doing networking research, and it says nothing about the mode of research. It says nothing about the solution approach. It only says, whatever I do, I'm going to try to apply it to this big problem. And it's very similar with software engineering. So the point is, don't think of an area just as this, these big headings, because the headings may mean nothing. Think of the mode of research, meaning, is it theoretical or applied? What's the flavor of the intellectual results? And does this inspire you? What is your job every day? Do you have to write code? Or you have to sit down on a desk and think? You have to push symbols around on a piece of paper or inside a theorem prover? Does this excite you? That's what should be your primary criterion. You really should like the mode of research in that area or sub-area and go for that. And don't trust big results, because we all love the big results in every area. Even in the areas that I consider the most boring, like algorithms. Oh, I love the big results. I would love to be the first person to find a linear algorithm for this celebrated problem that no one has solved in 30 years. But that's just the achievement. Really, I would hate to be the person who does the grunt work every day in algorithms and gets improvements of an algorithm to take it from n cubed log square of n to n cubed log n. You know, I don't want to be that guy. That doesn't excite me. Oh, you gave me an asymptotic complexity improvement, which is a complexity improvement in a theoretical model, but your algorithm is actually much worse for actual running time in real life. Okay, no, I'm not excited. So make sure that you like the incremental results in an area, not the big results. The big results can be very, very confusing. So you should like what people produce and everyone else in the community considers a good paper. You know, not like a lousy paper, of course, but a good paper, a good solid paper. Does this excite you? If it excites you, then that's a good area for you. So consider, you should consider these results important, or at least, even if you say, well, I can understand that it's not groundbreakingly important, but at least it's so cool. So that's how you can tell that this is a good area for you. So in business school, one of the maxims of business school is never fall in love with your cows. So business school professors tell this story of a rancher who had this farm, and he had cows in his farm, and his farm grew big and was a very successful enterprise. But at the time he was about to sell and make a lot of money, he really loved being a cow farmer. He loved having this ranch, and he just couldn't make himself sell. So he just waited, and then bad years came, and eventually he was led to bankruptcy. So at business school, they tell you, don't fall in love with your cows. They're just cows. You know, just do whatever you need just to make money, and don't care about the specifics, the little blocks on which your career is built. Doing your PhD is exactly the opposite of business school. It's exactly where you should fall in love with your cows. The little things that you deal with every day, you should love them, even if they're cows. So that's my last piece of advice. Questions, objections, anything? Yep.
Choose an area just because it's hot, but what if there's more funding in the area?
You mean what if it chooses you because otherwise you won't have funding? Well, if you have no choice, of course you have no choice. So we're always talking about cases where you have some choice. But if you have some choice, you shouldn't choose an area just because it has more funding, because you don't know whether it will have more funding when you really need the funding, which is 5 years from now when you graduate. You can never tell what area will be expanding at the time you will really rely on it for your career. Yeah. Because you feel the force. Come on, it's obvious. You like what you do, and you haven't felt that you have completed the training, and you feel you can go deep, and you feel inspired by that, and there's more, and you want to learn that more. Exactly the same reason as Luke Skywalker. Yeah?
So something that you said, which is quite true, is that as a PhD student, it's kind of one of... So you said it's the only moment of your life when you're paid for learning. And you also had advice on saying that, yeah, basically you can take all your time up to what funding gives you. So this in general would suggest that the PhD time is the best and you shouldn't finish, right?
So let me actually offer an anecdote. So you've heard the name Alan Shivers here. It was Matt Mite's advisor. He's a good friend of Olivier's, a good friend of mine. So Alan, when he was a grad student at CMU, he went to Alan Newell, who was his co-advisor. I think it was Alan Newell. Maybe he went to Peter Lee, his advisor. But he went to one of the two. And he said, so let me get this right. Other than the fact that you get a lot more money than me, is there any reason whatsoever why one should prefer your job to mine? And the advisor said, no. So please continue now.
Yeah, okay, but the same, but at least my experience has been a bit different, and I feel another kind of freedom in the post-PhD life that you don't have in the PhD life, which is that you're not obsessed by the fact that at some point you have to make a one coherent, full document of something, right? which is, during the life of PhD, something that is a bit stressful at times, right? Because you read something, you're interested by something which is a bit sidetracked, you want to go into it, but then it morphs a bit the topic, you have to fight maybe. This kind of thing, when you are after the PhD, if you want it, you go for it. If you are bored...
If you have tenure, yes. When you have tenure, yes. But not right away.
Well, it depends on the country, and probably. But
it depends on the country.
Typically, at least for the American system, you really don't want to go for it before. Before you want to have a very solid block of publications in a very specific area. You don't go off on tangents just because they interest you. You don't go into deep holes if you don't know how deep it's going to be, because you may not emerge the other side until 4 years later, and that's too late. But yeah, I agree with you. There is freedom with being a professor. That's pretty much the best thing about being a professor, because there are many other things of that job which are really lousy. But the freedom is tremendous.
There is actually a good motivation to finish.
That's true.
So thanks for that. Encourage people to finish as well. Yes. Yeah.
Is there a talk for advice after you've got your PhD?
After you got your PhD, and what role are you in?
I don't know yet.
Well, there are talks with advice on how to get a job. There are talks with advice on how to make it as a junior faculty member. There are certainly lots of things that are written about that. But most of them are fairly pragmatic advice. No one is trying to give you philosophy there or what should you do in order to be inspired. And no one tells you things like follow your heart, etc. It's more like, oh yeah, if you want to be successful here, make sure you manage your time like that, and you only allocate 2 hours in the morning to this, and then you do that, and you always make sure to write this many of these kinds of things, and don't spend more than 4 hours on anything unless it's going to be a bullet in your resume. You know, there are things like that. Very tedious, soul-sucking kind of advice that you get after. Okay? Yes?
I'd just like to follow up on a bit of the stuff with the reviews, which also follows up a bit on some of Olivier's remarks. But personally, I haven't seen that as an unconditional, always give your reviewers a comment and a thanks in that sense, but more to always appreciate the comments that are there, because no matter, as you said yourself, how incompetent it might seem, when you it's always easy to maybe throw off the remarks and say, ah, they didn't understand what I was saying. But when looking more closely at it, things dawn upon you, either because they maybe have seen something you didn't think they had seen, or because you get a better understanding of where the holes are.
I agree.
There are also careless reviews.
Definitely.
Very often there are reviews that do not try to place things in a global setting. But generally, I would agree with one thing. If someone misses the point, there's something in the writing that went wrong. So one experience that I had was with my advisor, and in terms of writing, every time I would write one of my first drafts in my first years of grad school, they would come back with several notes, and they would be really silly. You wouldn't have understood anything, like very simple stuff. Or I would make some really important point, something that I thought was really insightful, and he would say, ah, that's unnecessary, let's scratch it out. I was infuriated, like for a couple of years I was infuriated. And then by the time it was my fifth or sixth year or whatever, and I was working with him, every single point he was making was a good point. It was something that I had not written right. So there's definitely something to be said about take any feedback that comes back negative, take that constructively. But we should not try to say, oh, the review process is perfect and the reviewers are right. If the reviewers say that this is not an exciting topic, this is not an exciting topic. No. The reviewers are people under time pressure. You don't even know who they are. You don't know how much time they dedicated. You don't know what's their intellectual capacity. You don't know what's their level of interest. We should take all of that into context. But certainly if something is misunderstood, something is wrong, and it's a great talent to be seeing the reviews and understanding what exactly needs to be done to address that. Not to address the criticism exactly, but to see what was the misunderstanding, what was the misconception from the paper, and how this could be addressed to make the paper much better. Because typically that makes a paper tremendously better. Okay.